Germany calling.
It's that man again.
It's that man again. It's that man again. It's the comprehensive
bill. He may be a philological filibuster, but despite his passion for prevarication, this terminological inexactitudinarian still remains...
Father, pride and joy, Mrs. Hanfield's boy. Oh, it's useless to complain when trouble's brewing.
Tommy Handley and the Itmar team became the biggest comedy success of the war. But Lord Haw Haw, broadcasting Nazi propaganda from Germany, also had 6 million regular listeners by Christmas 1939, and his sense of humour was more sinister.
The British Ministry of Misinformation has been conducting a systematic campaign of frightening British women and girls about the danger of being injured by splinters from German bombs. The women have reacted to these suggestions and alarms by requesting their milliners to shape the spring and summer hats out of very thin tin plate, which is covered with silk, velvet, or other draping material.
Well, now my new air crew will be arriving at any moment, and they'll want a blanket to land on, so I'd better get weaving.
Can I do them now, sir?
If it isn't Mrs. Mopp, the sweetheart of the Sprogs. Now, look, I want you to look after the waps when they arrive.
Oh, sir, am I going to be a cipher queen?
A cipher queen? You'll be cipher as you are. But you must get in... You've got to get into uniform.
It'll be a bit drafty round me undercarriage, sir.
Oh, it'll be all right. You can wear 2 pairs of blackouts and a window sash.
It was the Christmas of the phony war, of sitting and waiting, the Sitzkrieg. The war was nearly 4 months old, and for British troops, fighting in earnest had yet to begin. There was so little war news that some newspaper sellers resorted to the sardonic cry, Germans in Berlin, evening paper. Scotsmen in Aberdeen, evening paper. It was Christmas almost as usual. Though many West End stores had turned their basements into air raid shelters, they reported the usual pre-Christmas shopping spree. But for George VI, the first Christmas of the war was a personal ordeal. Ever since he had come to the throne 3 years before, he'd refused to follow his father's tradition of a Christmas Day broadcast. The presence of a microphone always threatened to bring back the speech impediment from which he had suffered terribly as a child. But when war came, the king agreed, after much persuasion, to broadcast live from Sandringham on the afternoon of Christmas Day. The King ended his first Christmas broadcast with lines from a forgotten book of poetry which quickly became famous.
I said to the man who stood at the gate of the year, give me a light that I may tread safely into the unknown. And he replied, go out into the darkness and put your hand into the hand of God. That shall be to you better than light and safer than a known way. And may that almighty hand guide and uphold us all.
Next Christmas, the mood was very different. Christmas 1940 was the Christmas of the Blitz.
Well, you'll find a new pace about London's afternoons these days. As the clock moves on, everybody works like mad. Home before the siren is the motto these days. And people are streaming into the tubes and the buses, and the roads are filling up with cars from 3 o'clock onward. And so the London day ends. Another night, and with it, another warning. London settles down to listen to the barrage. Defence services go into action again. The wardens, the police patrol the streets and the parks, and the squares. The gun batteries and the barrage balloons are manned. The army of watchers is waiting, listening. London is guarded while she sleeps.
And soon we'll greet a new day with the sunrise and the hearts much lighter will be. Yes, friends, a new sunrise, a sun that will rise in a free and happy world. No more shadows of misery and persecution. Why, today we are living in the darkest hour, the hour just before the dawn. But we'll stick it out, always remembering the dark shadows cannot remain forever. That's why the world, the whole world, is waiting for the sunrise. Hear, Lord, send that sun.
We have had weeks of preparation for this celebration underground, and now we are just putting the final touches to everything. In between the sand-bagged partitions, the wooden bunks, one above the other, are decorated with flags and streamers. And across the arched roof, our guests have hung great festoons of coloured paper. I think this must be the strangest home that Santa Claus will ever have visited. For home it is for most of these guests of ours. The only home they've got. There may be more elaborate parties going on elsewhere today, I quite think there are. But there's certainly none with more of the true spirit of Christmas.
Merry Christmas!
Mom, Merry Christmas!
Well, that's typical of the way London carries on. The dawn comes again. London comes up from the shelters. And this is what London feels about the man who is striking at our heart.
He can't squash us. He never will. If he comes over for another couple of years, which we won't, we'll soon have him beat. Long before that, and he'll never get to you. Never.
This is London. We're all alive and kicking.
As we hope you are.
Cheerio, all the best.
You can take it.
You can't beat people like that.
In the city of Coventry that Christmas, a third of the population had lost their homes, and 100 acres of the city centre had been laid waste.
The bells of the bombed Cathedral of Coventry, striking 2 on the afternoon of this Christmas day, sound the greetings of Britain to the world.
I am speaking from the ruins of Coventry Cathedral. Last Christmas, we had our wonderful carol services in the glorious building of pink sandstone, which then stood above our heads. And what a beautiful cathedral it was. With its tall, slender pillars, its wide arches and spacious windows, every stone of it loved and treasured by 20 generations of Coventry people. 6 weeks ago, the enemy came and hurled down fire and destruction upon our city from the sky, all through the long night. So many lives were lost, so many homes destroyed, and our cathedral nave and chancel utterly burnt and brought to the ground. Here around me in the ruins are the few we could muster of the cathedral choir, and they're going to sing our ancient Coventry carol.
Yesterday, December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy.
United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked by naval and air forces of the Empire of Japan.
At Christmas 1940, Britain and the Empire had stood alone. A year later, we were alone no longer.
I ask that the Congress declare a state of war has existed between the United States and the Japanese Empire.
Winston Churchill spent Christmas in Washington conferring with President Roosevelt. On Christmas Eve, he stood on the White House steps to watch the lighting of the Christmas tree and broadcast to the world.
Let the children have their night of fun and laughter. Let the gifts of Father Christmas delight their play. Let us, grown-ups, share to the full in their unstinted pleasures. Before we turn again to the stern task and formidable year that lie before us, resolve that by our sacrifice and daring, these same children shall not be robbed of their inheritance or denied their right to live in a free and decent world.
To British servicemen abroad that Christmas, Freddie Griswood and Ronald Shiner brought messages from families at home, and Vera Lynn told them that sweethearts would still be faithful.
I've seen enough of you boys to know that you like your pals to think you're a bit of a heartbreaker with the girls. But women aren't like that. Once they've met the man they want, no one else counts. If you're lucky, you've got a girl like that. A girl who'll stick by you through all weathers, and all your ups and downs. You'll disappoint her. You'll hurt her. You'll make a fool of her. But she'll stand by you. She'll take the kicks. She'll be proud to call you my man. Fish got to swim, and birds got to fly. I got to love one man till I die. And hell, loving that man of mine.
This is London calling. This afternoon and every Friday afternoon at 17:30 GMT, London is calling British forces in Africa and in the Middle East with a program which we have called Your Cup of Tea. Now, what's the first thing your wife or your mother will say to you when you get home? Wouldn't you like a nice cup of tea? Well, the way things are for the present, you can't have a cup of tea with your wife or your mother, so we thought it would be a good idea for some of your wives and mothers to come and have tea with us and have a chat with you at the same time. Freddie Griswood is host at this party of ours and yours, and Bertha Wilmot is there to pour out and to sing your requests. Right now, gentlemen, come inside and join the party.
Now, ladies, please. Oh, now, Billy, help. Can't you stop it? I will have hush. Please. Now, quiet a minute, ladies. And we'll let your men folk out in Africa and the Middle East know who's here. Now, I'll start off this week. Sitting opposite to me is Mrs. Peters. Well, Mrs. Peters has got that black hat and coat on that she says you know so well. A very nice locket round her neck and a beautiful engagement ring. And Mrs. Peters comes from Leeds, don't you?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And who is it you want to talk to?
My husband, Eric Peters.
Well, that's capital. Well, you'll get a chance very soon.
This letter of mine is getting to be a sort of rendezvous where husbands and wives, torn apart by war, can be brought together by music. On the wings of these melodies, the sentiments go from me to both of you, from you to her.
Now, the next place we went to wasn't very far away, 129 South Road. And that's the home of John William Whelan. Are you listening, Mr. Whelan? The first thing your wife said when she opened the door and knew what we'd come for was, I wish I could get hold of a hurricane. I'd fly out to Malta. I think she would, too. She's certainly doing her job of work back there. Those kids look lovely. Son Terry with his head round one side of his mother's skirt and Maureen the other. Aren't they a pair of copper knobs, eh? I thought your wife looked marvellously fit, and here's a private little message to you. pray for a speedy return, and most of all, for victory. The ISC, diddy-dee-da.
And that's all my news and music. You'll hear from me again next week. Good night, boys. Sincerely yours, Vera Lynn.
We'll meet again. Don't know where. Don't know where. But I know we'll meet again. Some sunny day.
Though Vera Lynn became the Force's sweetheart, the BBC Board of Governors thought her show, Sincerely Yours, vulgar and wanted to take it off. The board minutes record just before Christmas 1941, Sincerely Yours deplored, but popularity noted. Most official wartime propaganda broadcast by the BBC was a good deal less successful and often more bizarre.
You gave me 2 shillings, 7 pence. Have you a penny, Mum?
Your change, sir. Thank you.
Cross that thunderbug. There he goes. Fat, gross, hideous, hairy, horrible, loathsome. Tread on him. Stamp on him. Cross that thunderbug.
Even as people began their Christmas shopping, they were warned against Hitler's deadly undercover agent, the Squanderbug.
If I don't spend that extra 11 to take me, well, I could put it into national savings or something.
National savings. National savings of 11 pence halfpenny. Oh, what a gesture. What a piece of patriotism. You really mean to stand there and tell me that by putting 11 pence halfpenny into national savings, you'll feel you've done something really great and sacrificial?
No, I suppose you're right there.
I am right.
Oh, really? Well, thank you, Mr. Higgins. I'll take a bottle of elixir. You couldn't spare me 2 bottles, could you?
As opinion surveys showed, most housewives ignored that sort of crude pre-Christmas propaganda. But the same surveys also found most women in favour of war work for themselves as well as men. Just before Christmas 1941, female conscription was introduced for the first time in British history. Young, unmarried women were called up to the auxiliary services and civil defence, to the hospitals, and to the munitions factories.
I am Barbara Morgan. I'm 20 years old. The day before yesterday, I was a cook. Now I'm in this big factory with lots of other girls, and I'm going to fill cartridges. It's all very strange, but I'm proud to be called to do my bit for the war. My hands are what they want most, and I shall be standing beside my brother in the Air Force, and I shall be standing beside everyone else who's fighting and working. I shall fill just as many cartridges as I can.
We've seen how British women are fighting and what they're doing, but, Diana, what do you think is in their minds as they do it? What are they fighting for?
I think they're fighting this war for the same thing as men, for the future.
Christmas night, 1942. Another Christmas when there is no peace anywhere on earth. For 3 long years, we have fought a black, relentless fight to win a way of life. And tonight, a light is shining on our path. Tonight, the way to victory is clear, and we are set on that way.
Christmas 1942 was a turning point in the war. Adolf Hitler spent the day in the Wolf's Lair, his secret headquarters deep inside a wood in East Prussia, taking sedatives as he listened to records of Beethoven. Less than 3 months before, he had boasted in an order of the day on the Eastern Front, "The Russian enemy is already defeated. He cannot rise again." By Christmas Day, Hitler knew that he was wrong. "The God of War," he told one of his generals, "has gone over to the other side."
Pause a moment to salute and greet that great army which tonight strikes its massive blows across the frozen rivers and plains of the East. Within the past few minutes, it has been announced that the Red Army has passed to the offensive southwest of Stalingrad and has advanced from 20 to 25 kilometers. Greetings to the fighters of the Red Army.
The tide of war was turning in North Africa as well as on the Eastern Front. In November 1942 had come the dramatic news of victory at El Alamein, the battle which Churchill called the hinge of fate.
This is the BBC Home and Forces program. This is Bruce Belford. Here's some excellent news which has come during the past hour in the form of a communique from GHQ Cairo. It says, the Axis forces in the Western Desert, after 12 days and nights of ceaseless attacks by our land and air forces, are now in full retreat. Their disordered columns are being relentlessly attacked by our land forces and by the Allied air forces by day and night. The Eighth Army continues to advance.
Ah, this is not the end. It is not even the beginning of the end. But it is perhaps the end of the beginning.
There was cause for celebration at Christmas 1942, but precious little feasting. Christmas dinner was a frugal affair.
I must say Christmas won't be the same this year, what with Bert and Wally away.
I know, but we've got to make the best of it, haven't we, Dave?
Of course we have. Or wish we had a turkey.
Well, you know how scarce they are.
I know.
But Dave, I've got a surprise for you. I've heard of a way of cooking a joint so you can mistake it for turkey.
Come on, I'll buy it. How do you set about this new recipe of yours?
Well, first of all, you want a leg of mutton, and ask the butcher to bone it.
One leg of mutton.
Mm-hmm.
1 pound of pork sausage meat.
1 pound.
Talking of food, I went into a restaurant the other day. Said to a fella, I'd like a steak and chips. He said, awfully sorry, no steak. I said, okay, I'll have a chop and chips. He said, sorry, no chops. I said, what do you got? He said, sausages. I said, well, I'll have sausages and chips. He said, sorry, no chips. I said, well, what have you got to go with the sausages? He said, a few kind words. I said, okay, sausages and a few kind words. When he brought the sausages, I said to the waiter, hey, just a minute, what about a few kind words? He said, okay, I wouldn't eat those sausages.
Now throughout the land, both near and far, people do their shopping while they may. And no matter who or where they are, this is what you'll hear them mostly say. Oh, butcher, do be sweet, sweet, sweet. Let me have the piece of kidney for my little son named Sydney. Oh, butcher, have you got a bit of meat, meat, meat? Sausages, I can't abide them. Our pet dog might be inside them. Oh, butcher, have you got a bit of meat, meat, meat?
Among the many broadcasts exchanged across the Atlantic that Christmas was this emotional message to the people of America.
A toast! A toast! I would like to propose a toast!
Just a minute, everyone. Just a minute. Someone wants to propose a toast. Hello, it's Esmond Knight. Esmond Knight is one of Britain's leading young actors. He served in the Royal Navy and was in the action when the Bismarck was sunk. In that engagement, Knight was blinded.
I want to give you a toast, America. This little island is filling up with men and with women who are going to lead with their left and swing with their right. Someone else is going to have a sore chin from now on. Things are beginning to happen. There's been a lot of talk. Now we're going to let the guns speak. You'd get a man's kick out of it. If you could see what's going on over here, America. Men are pouring in from the four corners of the world. The four corners of the world in arms. Black men, white men, brown men, men from everywhere and from the back of nowhere. Ladies and gentlemen, I give you a toast. The men and the women of the United Nations. Brothers in arms!
I arrived in London just the other day, speaking to a soldier from the USA. He told me of the army life he led, and speaking of the British boys, he said, my British buddy, we're as different as can be. He thinks he's winning the war, and I think it's me. But we're in there, pitching, and on one thing we agree.
Christmas 1943 was a time of optimism. The first Christmas of the war when victory seemed assured. Monty had a confident message for his troops.
Once again, the Eighth Army spends Christmas in the field. And I would say to you that you have every right to be very proud of what you have achieved during the past year. And today we recall the Christmas message. Glory to God in the highest, and on earth peace, goodwill toward men. Surely this describes exactly what we are fighting for. Let us therefore take it as our battle cry and our motto. And in doing so, let us affirm that between us, you and I, we will see this thing through to the end.
Strange contrast, and yet an apt one, for as one soldier said to me this Christmas Eve, peace on earth and goodwill towards men, those are exactly the things we're fighting for.
It is very close to Christmas Eve, but here it neither looks nor sounds like Christmas. We cannot escape the sounds of war. Listen to the sound of the guns. Ring out wild guns, not bells, to the wild sky. That's our Christmas cantata. But guns or no guns, the troops in the field will celebrate the Christmas, and with a Christmas dinner.
Now here we are in the cookhouse of this battalion headquarters, and here's the sergeant cook. I'm going to ask him what he's going to give his men for Christmas dinner. What are you going to give them, Sergeant?
Roast turkey, roast pork, and stuffing, roast potatoes, cabbage, peas, and finish up with Christmas pudding, mince pies, and rum sauce.
Good old rum. That sounds like a jolly good meal to me. And here's a whole crowd of chaps standing around me. What about a cheer for Christmas? Hip, hip.
Hooray! How are you today? How's your tongue? Is it smooth and red, or knobby and beige with an overcoat of a muddy hue? And how's the stomach? Is it firm and steady, or somewhat warm, or a little wobbly and a trifle windy? Or was your Christmas day so Spartan that today you're fighting fit with no twinge of remorse? Oh, you may be off your victuals. Your mouth may faintly resemble a birdcage. There may be heartburn, the digestive, not the amorous kind. There may be fullness. There are those who resolutely refuse to hear the whispering message of the lower bowel, whose motto would seem to be, what I have, I hold. Constipation may even be due to taking medicines to cure it, to taking laxatives as a routine. Please don't whip your bowel each day into a chronic frenzy of irritable activity.
Boxing Day advice from the radio doctor Charles Hill, who went on to become chairman of the BBC. Winston Churchill's health suffered that Christmas. Like many British troops, he spent Christmas in the Mediterranean. The Prime Minister was a reluctant guest at a villa in Tunisia. Stranded, he complained, amid the ruins of Carthage, with a fever which has ripened into pneumonia. For one dreadful moment, it seemed that this Christmas might be Churchill's last. On the 15th of December, he had a heart attack. Lord Moran, his doctor, admitted that he hadn't expected the Prime Minister to survive the night. But the crisis passed, and Churchill bounced back to health with surprising speed. His cigars, however, were taken away for Christmas, and his whiskey drowned in soda water. For the German people, it was the grimmest Christmas of the war so far. On Christmas Eve, the Red Army launched a great winter offensive on the Eastern Front. The RAF and the American Air Force were in the middle of a bombing campaign against German cities, even more terrible than the London Blitz.
1 minute to go now. Bomb doors open.
Bomb doors open. Left, left. Steady. Steady.
Arms away.
30.
There goes the cookie.
Lucky, lucky, lucky. Take Jettison action.
Jettison action now.
Okay, I think they're firing it up. Bomb, yeah, those players.
Bomb those players.
Right there.
Berlin was a kind of orchestrated hell, a terrible symphony of light and flame. It isn't a pleasant kind of warfare. The men doing it speak of it as a job. Yesterday afternoon, when the tapes were stretched out on the big map, all the way to Berlin and back again, a young pilot with old eyes said to me, "I see we're working again tonight." That's the frame of mind in which the job is being done. The job isn't pleasant. It's terribly tiring. Men die in the sky while others are roasted alive in their cellars.
Got him! My God, that looks a bloody good show, doesn't it?
Yes, it's certainly good playing, I believe.
Yes, a wizard show tonight.
Berlin last night wasn't a pretty sight. In about 35 minutes, it was hit with about three times the amount of stuff that ever came down on London in a night-long blitz. This is a calculated, remorseless campaign of destruction. Right now, the mechanics are probably working on D-Dog, getting him ready to fly again.
In his Christmas message to the American people, President Roosevelt gave a clear hint that 1944 would see the D-Day landings.
The Russian army will continue its stern offensive on Germany's Eastern Front. The Allied armies in Italy and Africa will bring relentless pressure on Germany from the south. And now the encirclement will be complete as great American and British forces attack from other points of the compass. The commander selected to lead the combined attack from these other points is General Dwight D. Eisenhower.
General Eisenhower had an uncomfortable Christmas with the American troops in Italy. Just before Christmas, he moved into new headquarters at the Caserta Palace in Naples. He got stuck in the lift. His fireplace was blocked, and there were lice in his bed. On entering his bathroom, he found a rat, drew his revolver, and fired four times. He missed.
This is D plus 208. The end is not yet, but it is near. The year is ending for us, but much more is ending for Hitler. Not that we must underrate the job that still needs doing. The snake is dangerous till you've crushed his head.
The big German counteroffensive on the American First Army front is still going on. The enemy has poured more infantry and more tanks into the battle this morning after a pause of about 12 hours. Before the Germans launched this counteroffensive, von Rundstedt, the German commander-in-chief in the West, issued an order of the day to the troops under his command. It read, "Soldiers of the West Front, your great hour has struck. You all feel it. Everything is at stake. You have the sacred duty to give everything and to achieve the superhuman for Führer and the Fatherland."
Christmas 1944 was the coldest for more than 50 years, and Hitler's surprise attack in the Ardennes on the 16th of December cast a shadow over the celebrations. Once again, Londoners sought shelter, this time from the doodle bugs and V-2 rockets, which destroyed many thousands of homes. But Monty, like the British people, had no doubt that victory was certain.
forces of the British Empire in Western Europe spend Christmas 1944 in the field. But what a change has come over the scene since last Christmas. It would have needed a brave man to say on D-Day, the 6th of June, that in 3 months we would be in Brussels and Antwerp, having liberated nearly the whole of France and Belgium. And in 6 months, we would be fighting in Germany, having driven the enemy back across his own frontier. But this is what has happened. And we must not fail to give the praise and honor where it is due. This was the Lord's doing, and it is marvelous in our eyes. Therefore, with faith in God, and with enthusiasm for our cause and for the day of battle, let us continue the contest with stout hearts and with determination to conquer. Together, you and I, we have achieved much. And together, we will see the thing through to the end.
Let's have a red, white and blue Christmas. Let's show the world how we feel. It's the same old story of hope and glory that history will reveal. Let's have a red, white and blue Christmas. It brings this message to you. While the bells are ringing, the world is singing the praises of the red, white and blue.
Now to the British Army, which is furthest away from home today. The 14th Army in Burma. Are you ready, Mrs. Till, and Paul, and Stephen?
We're thinking of you now, Cliff. All of us sitting round the fire at Bill's. We're thinking of you and all the men in the 14th Army very far from home. I know there are hundreds of families like ours in Britain today. I am speaking for them all when I say a happy Christmas, dear, and a safe journey home. There were 11 of us sat down to dinner, Christmas dinner, and we sang Grace to Remington as usual before we began. We toasted absent friends and remembered how you used to take Paul upstairs to bed after dinner to sleep off the Christmas hangover. He was still a baby then, but he's here now and wants to say hello to his daddy for the first time. You've not heard him speak before, Cliff.
Hello, Daddy. Father Christmas came last night and bought me a Jeep.
And here's Stephen. He's almost up to my shoulder now.
Hello, Daddy. Happy Christmas. Come home soon. I want you to teach me to swim.
All the family would like to speak to you, but there isn't time. So for them all, I'm saying, God bless you, Cliff, and all the men in Burma fighting with you.
The 6th Christmas of the war emphasized once again to countless families the pain of separation. At Sandringham, however, servicemen were invited to the 4th wartime pantomime staged by the teenage princesses. This year, as well as devising a pantomime called Old Mother Red Riding Boots, they also put on a ballet set in a Victorian seaside resort. 18-year-old Elizabeth played a seaside belle, and 14-year-old Margaret, a Victorian schoolgirl. King George VI faced his last Christmas broadcast of the war with greater confidence than ever before. For the first time, the king asked his wife and daughters to sit by him as he broadcast from Sandringham to the peoples of the empire.
We do not know what awaits us when we open the door of 1945. But if we look back to those earlier Christmas days of the war, we can surely say that the darkness daily grows less and less. The lamps which the Germans put out all over Europe, first in 1914 and then in 1939, are being slowly rekindled. And let us hope that before next Christmas Day, God willing, the story of liberation and triumph will be complete.
I'll be seeing you in every lovely summer day, in everything that's light and gay. I'll always think of you that way. I'll find you in the morning sun, and when the night is blue, I'll be looking at the moon, but I'll be
The Dark Christmases was presented by Dr. Christopher Andrew and produced in Manchester by Julie Simmons.